Rabban page 200 in Bava Basra, Ois Kuf Yud Gimel. Continuing on the topic of Yerusha and the various arrangements that can be made to modify or bypass it or whatever, the Mishnah says, HaKosev Nechosev L'Acherim, if a person writes away, writes a document giving away his Nechosim to others, not to his children, V'niach HaZbonav, and he leaves aside his children and doesn't give them, and disinherits them, Masha Osa Osri, what he did is done. In other words, just like any person can give Matana, he has the ability to do it. Aval Einu HaChachamim, Noichahimenu, but the Chachamim are not pleased with him. In fact, Mashbam says, on the contrary, they're angry at him. The Chachamim would be angry at such a person. How could he take away? The Torah says that a person's Nachla is supposed to go to his children or to the various other relatives that are described in the Pesukim over there. How could he be overriding?
Gifts during his life, though.
No, well, so that's what we're saying. He has the legal right to, but what's legal is not always what's right. So here we're saying it's legal for him to do it. He's able to do it. It is effective as a legal halakhic matter. But the Chachamim are not pleased with him for doing it.
Self-conscious. The Torah says, yes, go to your children. How can you tell them?
Because he has the ability. Because exactly that. A person has the ability to give gifts while he's alive. Now, if he were to say, for example, after I die, I want my Nechosim to go to Pliny, then yeah, that's not so straightforward in the Perek it talks about, in the Gemara it talks about he doesn't have, once he dies, and automatically it's Yarshin by his children, so he doesn't have the ability to modify that. But here we're talking about while he's alive, he says that he's giving a gift. I mean, you have all kinds of complications in it. You can have when the gift takes effect. V'chola, that's, you know, it's a long perek. It's a perek that runs over 30 blot. And a large part of it deals with these kinds of complications and things. But anyway, the point is that legally he can do it, but the Chachamim are not happy with him for it. Reb Shimon Gamliel Omer, im lo hayu bonav noigin kashura, Reb Shimon Gamliel says, if his children were not acting in an erlich, a proper way, zochru latoiv, then he should be remembered for good. In other words, then it's a good thing to disinherit his children. The Gemara explains, the Chachamim counter that and say, fine, maybe his children don't deserve to yashin it, but what if his children have good children, and why should they be deprived of it? So therefore, even if the children are no good next, the Chachamim don't want you, the Chachamim against the Shimon Gamliel, don't want you disinheriting them. In fact, an interesting vote on that is when Sarah tells Avraham to kick out Yishmael, and the pasuk says Yera Adover, that he felt very bad about it. So one explanation is Taka, because he figured, like the Chachamim are saying over here, what if Yishmael eventually has good descendants? Hayitachen, we should disinherit them. So he was told, listen to what Sarah says. He's not going to have any good descendants anyhow. It's brought someplace. I think it's brought in some well respected sefer. I don't remember which one. That there have been many geirim throughout the generations from Esav, but there have never been any from Yishmael. We have sometimes there are Arabs who become geirim, but the Arabs all mixed up anyhow between Yishmael and Keturah and Yoktan and who knows who else. So maybe if you were to trace it back, you would find that they're not actually descended from Yishmael. Maybe even the Zohar brings, or I don't remember. It's brought in some Sifrei Kabbalah, I don't remember, that there have never been any Geirim from Yishmael. So then that fits very well with this explanation. So therefore, Avraham has nothing to worry about disinheriting Yishmael.
He did do tshuva,
fine, but still, you know. Okay, fine. So the Gemara tells in this connection a story. Yosef ben Ye'ezer, this is the Yosef ben Ye'ezer that we had in last week's Pirkei Avos, Hoyle ben Shloihei Noig Kashura. He had a son who wasn't acting in a proper way. He went off the derech. We would think it's shocking that the Nasi Yisrael had a son who that happened to. Unfortunately, we have such things in many different generations. But that period also, we should also realize Yosef ben Ye'ezer and Yosef ben Yochanan lived in the time of the beginning of the Messiavim. Yosef ben Ye'ezer himself, actually, the Medrash that says that he was killed by the Yevonim, and it actually mentions in that connection a story. It actually mentions in that connection a nephew of his who was a very high-ranking Misyavin and was riding on a horse on Shabbos and saying to Yosef ben Ye'ezer, look at me, look how important I am, and look how they're treating you, and you're about to be killed. And Yosef ben Ye'ezer says, "In the over tzone kach lo oser tzone alachas kama v'kama, how much more so reward Hashem has for the tzaddikim and punishment." For the Rishoyim, and it actually had such an effect. The Medrash goes on to say it had such an effect on this nephew that he actually went and did Tshuva on the spot and was the Kaim and himself for Dalad Mrs. Basin. But it was a time, Poshut, you know, with all the Misyavnim and everything. So here we have, there was a nephew of Yosef ben Ezer who went off the Derech. I guess we shouldn't be entirely surprised that he had a son who wasn't as good as he should have been either. Anyway, have you like Elisa de Dimri? Now Yosef ben Ezer had an Elisa full of gold, dinim. This is the simple meaning of Elisa would be an attic, a second floor of the house. But since in the continuation of the story, we're going to end up talking about 13 such things, then that seems like a little of an exaggeration. So Tosfos brings it, Rabbeinu Tam explains, it doesn't mean actual aliyas, it doesn't mean attics, but rather the ladle that you use to ladle out wine from a jug is also called an Elisa. So therefore, it means he had a ladle full of gold dinim. So that reduces the amount by a significant amount. Anyway, so he had that money, so he didn't want that his son should inherit it, this no-goodnik son. Come, Akdash al-Shamayim. So Yosef ben Ezer was makdash it to the Beis, was makdash the money to the Beis Mikdash. Ozol Brei, eventually the son went, Nosif Bas Godo Klili V'Yanei Malka. He ended up marrying the daughter of the person who used to weave wreaths or crowns for Yanei HaMelech. Yanei was one of the kings of the Hashmonaim, so he would wear crowns or wreaths, and he had somebody whose official job was making those for him. So Yosef ben Ezer's son married this guy's daughter. Elida Dvesu, his wife gave birth. Isila Bunisa, so he went and bought her a fish to eat after the birth as a special treat. Kora, when he opened up the fish, he found a pearl or a precious stone in it. We have that with Yosef Meikra Shabbos. We have a number of such stories. So here we have another one. Omrole, so his wife tells him, what tintia the Bay Malka? Now, the obvious thing would be, you have a jewel like that, what are you going to do? You're going to go sell it to the palace. They can always, they're always on the lookout for jewels and things like that. She tells him, don't bring it to the palace for them to buy it from you, because you don't really know how much it's worth. They will end up buying it from you at a lower price than it should really fetch. In other words, they're going to take advantage of you. You don't know how much it's really worth. They're going to offer you a price, and you're not going to know better, and you're going to accept it. So she tells him, Zil amtia gizbere de be mikdasha. Go bring it to the treasurers of the Beis Mikdash. They're honest, and therefore you know that they'll give you the full value of it. We find, by the way, in histories from that time, we find, for example, that people would often deposit, for example, the Yisoimim, who had fortunes, would deposit them for safekeeping in the treasuries of the Beis Mikdash. You look at the blueprint of the Beis Mikdash and the Masechta Midas and then the Rambam and Hilchos Beis HaBechira, and you have all, and then in Yechezkel, and you have all these toyim, all these little rooms around the Heichel. It's very possible some of those serve to store such things. Be that as it may, she tells him, take it to the treasurers, and she tells him another detail as well. Now, don't you make an offer of how much you think it's worth that they should pay you. You see, this is a smart lady, and she knows her stuff. You saying, the thing is, when it comes to a hedyot, when it comes to doing business between two people, if I say to you, I'm going to sell you for such and such, I'm not obligated necessarily to hold by that. Only when there was some kind, of kinyan, then it's irrevocable. If money changed hands, then you have a concept that we learned in Bava Metzia called Misha Parah, where the person who reneges on the deal is cursed in basting. But if you just verbally say it's called a deal that was just done with Dvorim Ba'alma, then you're not necessarily held to it. But with Hektish, it's not like that. When you say something to Hashem, you say you're going to donate something, or you're going to whatever, to Mesira Lahedyet, it's the equivalent, it has the force of Mesira, of actually handing it over and making a kinyan when it comes to a Hedyet. So if you go to the Gizborim, for example, and tell them you want $1 million for it, and they look at it and they find out it's worth $2 million, you're not going to be able to collect on the $2 million, because once you said $1 million, then it's as if you pledge the rest to Hektish. So she tells him, make sure that they're the ones who evaluate it. And then you can decide whether to accept or reject their offer. Well, Amtie, sure enough, he brought it to the treasurers of the Beis Mikdash. Shaimur b'klesiri Elisa de Dinri. They evaluated that it's worth 13 Elisa of gold dinar. So again, in the straightforward meaning, Elisa would mean attics, would mean there's second floors of houses, in which case you're talking an enormous fortune. Again, Tosfos says that maybe not, maybe it means ladlefuls. It's still a nice chunk of change, but not necessarily that much. Anyway, Amrilei, but they told him, Sheva Ika, right now in the treasury of the Beis Mikdash, we have 7 Elisa of gold coins. She slept up, but we're still lacking 6. So basically, if you want to sell it to us, we're going to have to owe you the rest. Omolahu, so he tells them, Sheva Havoli, fine, give me the 7 that you have. Shis, as far as the other 6, Harein Mekudoshes HaShemayim, I'm being Makdish then to Hektish, so you won't have to pay me those 6 later on. Omdu Vakosvu, so they went and wrote down, Rashbam points out, they had account books, they would keep the accounts of the Beis HaMikdash. So they wrote in their account books, and Yosef and Yezer, Hichnis Echad, Yosef and Yezer, the father of this guy, brought in 1 Elisa of gold coins to the Beis HaMikdash, because like we said at the beginning of the story, he was Makdish, his 1 Elisa. Ubnoi Hichnis Sheish, his son, brought in 6. In other words, look how much better he is than his father. In a way, he gave the Beis HaMikdash 6 times as much as his father did. The Ikadamri, others say on the contrary, they wrote Yosef and Yezer Hichnis Echad Ubnoi Hotzi Sheva. The other version of it is they wrote, the father brought in 1, the son took out 7, in which case it's meant as less of a compliment to him, meaning he took 7 because that was what was available, and if there had been all 13, he would have taken all 13, and either way, he like completely emptied out the treasury of the Beis HaMikdash. So you see from that, though, you see how it was in Hashemayim, that Yosef ben Yezer wanted to disinherit his son, and the Eidishter arranged that in the end, not only the son got back that 1 Elisa, and many more. So the Gemara goes on in this connection. Omele Shmuel Rabbi Yehuda. So Shmuel tells Rabbi Yehuda, who was his star Talmud, Shinina, sharp one. We have all over Shas where Shmuel calls Rabbi Yehuda Shinina. The standard explanation is it means he's calling him the sharp one because he was very sharp in learning Torah. There's an explanation that the Oruch brings that it means that he had big teeth, and he's calling him Shinina as like the toothy one. Anyway, that was his favorite nickname for Rabbi Yehuda all over Shas. He calls him Shinina. Don't ever be involved in a case, and don't ever sit on a base in where you're going to be judging a case where the father is taking away the nachla and disinheriting a child. Even if he's disinheriting a bad child in favor of a good one, don't do it. Or even disinheriting completely. Rashbam points out, even if he's just that, for example, you're giving extra to one son over another, nevertheless, don't get involved in such things. V'cholshekin mibro lebrata, how much more so if the father wants to take away from the son and give to the daughters, where b'chlal, the Torah says that when there's sons and the daughters don't even inherit in the first place, so then don't be involved in such things that override what the Torah says. Because even though we're saying in the Mishnah, you are technically allowed to do it, nevertheless, it's not the right thing to do, and you shouldn't be involved, you shouldn't sit on a base stint or be an aide or in any way be involved in such a thing. And again, the idea is even if the child, as the Chachamim had said against Reb Shimon Gamliel, even if this particular child is a no good nick, nevertheless, he may have children who end up being good. More on this topic of disinheriting children and deciding differently what should be. By the way, Ben Yehoyada points out, you know, the word Echad is Gematria 13. So Yosef ben Yezer brought in Echad, and his son also was involved with Echad, except he didn't collect all 13. He left 6 of them to the treasury of the Beis HaMikdash. But it was the koyach of the father is what brought about the schus of the son. So the Gemara tells Tan Rabbanan, Ma'isa ba'adam echad shalayhoi v'nev noigin kashura. It happened once, there was a certain man whose children weren't acting properly. Omad v'kosim nechosim v'yonis in Benazil. So he went and wrote out a document giving his nechosim to Yonis in Benazil. Ma also Yonis in Benazil. So what did he do? He wanted to demonstrate that he has full rights to do whatever he wants with the property. So he sold 1/3 of it. The Hikdish Shlish, he donated 1/3 of it to Hikdish. The Hechzer, the Bonav Shlish, and he returned 1/3 to the children. This way, he was demonstrating that he has full control over this property. Rashbam points out this way he's demonstrating he has full control, and therefore, even though the father didn't want that the Nechosim should go to his sons, nevertheless, he has full rights to do that on his own. Well. Ba'al of Shammai, the Makloi Ratamilai. Shammai came to argue with Yonis and Benazir with his stick and with his bag, meaning it was like he's coming, like he plans to stay there a while, like he's gonna argue it out with Yonis and Benazir and say what you did was wrong. So in other words, Rashbam teaches out in some detail that the fact that you can't have returned it to his children, because when he first did this, he wanted that his sons should not have hanah from it. So in fact, what you should do is the matana is not really a valid matana either. Really, you should take it all back. Mitzvah l'kayim divrei ames. Rashbam points out the Gemara further on explains there's a story involving in Masechta Nedarim where a guy was making a chasana and his father was mudr hana. He had made previously a neder that his father won't have hana from him, but now he wants to be able to invite his father to the chasana. So it's a whole story over there of how he gave it to somebody else, saying that you'll make the wedding and then you'll be able to invite my father. And the other guy says, look, if the property is mine, I can give it to Hektish. And so it's called Maisa de Beis Chorin, because it happened in the city of Beis Chorin in Eretz Yisrael. So Rashbam explains that the Gemara goes on to say that Shammai misunderstood the implication of that story and thought that it applies similarly over here, that therefore Yonis and Menaziel does not have the right to do with this property whatever he wants. Tosfos, by the way, points out an interesting thing. The Yerushalmi, when it tells the story, has it differently. The Yerushalmi has not that some random father didn't want his son to inherit and therefore gave it to Yonis and Benaziel, and Shammai came to argue, but rather the Yerushalmi's version of the story is that Yonis and Benaziel's own father disinherited him and then gave the money to Shammai. So same protagonist, same characters, but in a different playing different roles. Anyway. So Omale, so Yonis and Benaziel tells him, Shammai, imati yochel lohotzi masha machauti o masha ekdashti, if you're able to take away what I sold and what I was makdish, if you argue that I don't have rights on those, ati yochel lohotzi masha echzauti, then yes, you'd also be able to take away what I returned to the children, because then you're right, it means, in other words, that I don't have full control over the property. Vimlav, but if not, and you yourself, after all, agree that I have every right to sell the property or to give it to Hektish because it was mine, the father gave it to me unconditionally, then you're not able to take back what I gave to the children, to the children either. So by Maisa de Beis Chorin, he says that I didn't give it to you in order to be Makdashit. But here, Rashbam explains, Yonis and Benaziel is saying, the father never said, I can't be Makdashit. I didn't imply any such thing. So if I have a right to be Makdash and I have a right to sell it, and you agree to that, then I have every right to also give back to the children as well. Omar, Shammai answered like in a joking way, he tiach alai ben uziel. Ben Uziel has thrown against me. He tiach literally means to throw, like to throw mud or something, but it's sometimes used in the Gemara. You have the expression, he tiach dvorim klapi maila, like somebody speaks in a sharp accusatory tone towards the Eibishter. So in the same way, he's saying over here, like in a joking way, look at this, Ben Uziel, cast up a good solid argument against me, and I have no answer. So now talking about Yonis and Benaziel, Ben Yehoyada points out, first of all, the double expression is, because after all, there are two things Yonis and Benaziel told him, two things that I did that you agree are valid, the selling and the giving to Hektish. And the reason why does he call him Ben Uziel? Usually calling someone Ben his father is a bit of a derogatory way of talking, like we find when they said Ben Amram, for example, he says, because Uziel stands for Oiz Kael, the power of Hashem. So therefore, so he's calling him Ben Uziel, the one who really has the power of Hashem as embodied in the Torah, and therefore he was able to reach the right conclusion. So talking about Yonis and Benaziel, the Gemara goes on. Tana Rabbanan, Shmonim Talmidim Hoyle Lehilul Azokin. Hilul Azokin had 80 Talmidim. Now he had thousands of Talmidim, but it means among his main Talmidim there were 80. His main Talmidim were numbered 80. Shloishim Mehem Ruim Shetishraleim Shkina Kamosh Rabbeinu. Eight of them, 30 of them would have been deserving have the Shekhinah rests on them like Moshe Rabbeinu. Now, Lo'kom Novi Obisir or Kamosha, so we don't mean they would have been a Moshe's caliber as far as Nevuah, but we mean, in other words, as far as that limited point, they would have been a Roy for that had it not been. Rashbam points out the people of that generation were not Roy for it. The Gemara mentions a similar thing in Sanhedrin, that one time the Chachamim were sitting together, and a Baskel said, there's one person among you that's Roy, that the Shekhinah should rest on him like a Novi, except that the generation isn't worthy for it, and the Chachamim realized that's referring to Hillel, and there was a similar story in another generation, and they realized that it refers to Shmuel Akkotin. So in a similar vein, over here, Hillel's 30 top Talmidim were also Roy that the Shekhinah should be able to rest on them.
Is the famous Hillel,
yeah. Yeah, we call him Hillel HaZaken, partially because when he became, well, first of all, and there were later Hillels as well, so HaZaken can mean the first one, same as Rav Gamliel HaZaken, but second of all, partially, I mean, he was 80 when he became Nasi. He lived 120 years, the Medrash tells us. He was born in Bavel, he grew up over there, became a distinguished Talmid Chacham. When he was 40, he came to Eretz Yisrael to learn Bashmaya in Italian. Then he left and returned to Bavel, came back when he was 80, that was when there was the whole story with Bnei Beseira and Er Pesach and Shabbos and all that, and they appointed him as Nasi, and for the last 40 years, he led the Jewish people as Nasi. So partially, he was Zokin. Shammai also, sometimes we call Shammai a Zokin, I guess for the same reason. So the same way. So again, Samarsha makes the connection explicit. The same way as Hillel was Roy that the Shekhinah should rest on him. The same way his top 30 Talmidim were the same way. Marshall also points out the connection is also that Moshe's asset was Anivus, Ish Moshe Onav Ma'od, and because of, and then the Pasuk mentions after that he was the highest level Novi and nobody compares to him. Well, Hillel also was a famous Onav, as we know from the various stories. So they had that as well. Next, Shloshim Mehem, another 20 of them, Ru'oyim Shetamad Lem Chamaki Yeshua Ben Nun. They would have been worthy that the sun could stand still for them like Yeshua. Now, so in other words, they're not on the level of Moshe, but they're on the level of Yeshua, who was the Talmud of Moshe, as we learned earlier in the Masechta, that Moshe's face was like the sun, and Yeshua's face was like a reflection of it, like the moon. So they were the next degree. That's true. Yeshua was your set to Tzedek of Vav Nissen. I forgot about that. Thank you. Yeah, very Shkocha process that we're learning about this. Good. Thank you. Rashbam points out, I mean, the sun actually, the Gemara tells us in Avodah Zarah, the sun stood still for Moshe as well during the battle with Sichon. So why are we saying that it would have stood still for them like Yeshua? Because we already mentioned Moshe, so therefore mentioning Yeshua. But they're not on the level of Moshe, but they're on the level of Yeshua. Esrim Benanim, and then there were 20 who were average. Average, we're going to see what the average means. It's a lot more than what we would think of, but nevertheless, in other words, they're not at the level of their Rebbe, but nevertheless, they're greater than being plain old Talmidim. Rashbam explains they were basically on the level of Talmud Chaver. Gadol Shebekulam, now among these Talmidim, the greatest of them was Yonasan ben Uzziel. Cotton Shabakulam, the least, it could mean the youngest, it could mean the least accomplished or whatever, was Rabbi Yechon ben Zakkai. Many Mephoshim understand that it means across the 80 Talmidim. The greatest of the 80 Talmidim was Yonasan ben Uzziel. The least was Rabbi Yechon ben Zakkai. Rabbeinu Gershom over here on the Gemara explains it means among the 20 Beinanim. Among the 20 Beinanim, Yonasan ben Uzziel was the greatest and Rabbi Yechon ben Zakkai was the least. A couple of them, before we point out, we don't mean least. I mean, after all, he became the Av Beis Din of the next generation. He was the Mekabel HaTorah for that, as we have in this coming week's Pirkei Avos. Rabbi Yechon ben Zakkai, Kibbel Mehillel Mishamai, and then you have his five Talmidim, and the whole Torah Sheval Peh passes through him. But what it means is, in other words, in particular, about the things that the Gemara is going to go on to mention, the various aspects of knowledge that the Talmidim of Hillel knew, he was the least knowledgeable in that, and yet the Gemara is going to talk about how knowledgeable he was. So, Amru Olavar, Rabbi Yechon ben Zakkai. So they said about Rabbi Yechon ben Zakkai, you want to know how accomplished and how great he was, and then by comparison, you can imagine how great the other Talmidim were. Shalahiniach, he didn't leave aside a single part of the following things that he didn't learn. Mikra, Tanakh, Mishnah, Gemara. Now, this is long before the Mishnah was even written, let alone the Gemara, but Mishnah means the basic, the standard formulation of the halachas in short words, like the Mishnah that we have, which became eventually the Mishnah that we have, and Gemara would be all the discussion and analysis as what we have that eventually became the Gemara Bavli and Yerushalmi. Halachos, Halachos for Moshe Sinai, he knew all of them. Vahagodos and all the Agadus, in particular, Rashbam says Hagodos means the various Midrashim and Psukim. For example, he says like Medrash Tanchuma, Bereshis Rabba, Vayikra Rabba, these are not Midrashi Halacha, where the Chachamim learn out Halachos from the Psukim. That's the next thing, Dukei Torah, but rather Haggadah is where the Chachamim give us a Gadda based on the Psukim, as what we usually think of as Medrash. So all that, Dukei Torah, all the details of the Torah, all the details, for example, where sometimes we learn a din from one particular letter in the Torah. One example Rashbam gives over here is from last week's parasha, Vizela Chamatome, and we learn from that Vav, or according to another opinion from the Hay, that the blood of a sheret is metame, unlike the blood of other kinds of animals. So we learn that from just one letter, that's Dukei Torah. The Dikduke Sofrim, and also the details of the Sofrim, of the Chachamim of later generations, the Gzeiros, that are the Gzeiros and Takanas that the Chacham made, that we shouldn't be Orvani Surei Torah, they're called Dikduke Sofrim, because the Chachamim were Medayek in how people act, and how people think, and they made the Gzeiros tailored to that appropriately. The Kalim v'Chamorim, all the Kal v'Chomers that we use to darshan things in Torah, or Gzeiros Shavus, all the Gzeiros Shavus that we use to learn halachas, such as Rashbam says, for example, the fact that we learn that here now in Rambam and Shlosha Prachim we're starting to learn Hilchos Ishus, and the Rashbam gives an example of that, the fact that you can be Makadish, a woman with money, but Kesef of a Shavah Kesef, we learn by Gzeiros Shavah, Kicha Kicha, Mr. Ephraim. So that's an example of that. Or Tkufos. And the Tkufos, Rashbam says that means the Molodos of the moon. Marsha points out, usually the word Tkufos has a different meaning, means the exact moments of the beginnings of the seasons that are calculated by the motions of the sun. Here, and also in Shlosha Prakim of Rambam, the few days over Pesach, we had a Hilchos Kiddush HaChodesh, which goes into all those in great detail. And as the Rambam points out over there, there were Sforim on that topic that were written by Shevet Yisachar, who were the experts on it in the Sanhedrin, but we don't have those books. Now all we have is books written on the topic by various Goyish scientists, and then the Rambam used that information and made it again part of Torah by putting it into Hilchos Kiddush HaChodesh. Anyway, so all that, the Gematrios, and Gematrios, which includes Rashbam explains that means what we usually think of, what we usually call Netrikun, which are initials, when we darish in a word in the Torah as the initials of a phrase, like Anochi Anon Afshis Tzavis Yehovis, or other examples like that. Gematrios also means, in the more simple sense, when the things that we learn from Gematria, sometimes we learn actual halachas from it. In Daf HaYomi, a few days ago, for example, the Gemara had explained how we know that a hin is 12 lugim, is because the one place where the Torah mentions a hin as a complete measurement is when Moshe was making the Shemen HaMishpah, and Hashem says, Shemen Mishpas Kodesh Yezzeh Li, and the word Zeh is Gematria 12, teaching us that a hin is 12 lugim. And other examples like that. So that's also Gematrios. Umesholis Kovsim. Also the analogies and metaphors that about laundrymen. So it can mean ones that laundrymen themselves sell over. Laundrymen always in the Gemara are considered to be like a very low class occupation. So even the Mesholim that they say, from which we can help learn that and illuminate something in Torah, it can also mean Mesholim that involve laundrymen as one of the characters in the Mesholim. Or Mesholis Shualim, and the Mesholim, or the parables involving foxes. The Gemara gives a couple of examples in them in Sanhedrin. We'll get to it in a few weeks, Bez Hashem. The Gemara mentions that Rav Meir knew 300 of them, and all we know is a couple. But all those sorts of things, again, we can learn from them. We can learn from them to understand things in Torah. Sichas Shadim, the speech of Shadim, which means, Parshat, how they speak. Rashbam points out, this way you can beswear them this way. For example, if a person is sick and he needs to make and he's being attacked, and because he's being attacked by Shadim, then you can write a Kameah to help cure him. So it's important for that reason to know how they speak and how to speak to them. So the Sichas Dekolim, also the speech of trees, the speech of palm trees. Some Mephoshim explain, but Rashbam explains that means what people speak about trees. For the same way by Shlomo HaMelech says, by Dabra Ala Eitzim, he spoke regarding the trees. So the same way, people talk about trees, so Rabbi Yechon and Zakkai knew everything that they talk about them. A number of the Rishonim bring from Rabbi Hai Goin that there actually means the speech of the trees themselves. And Rabbi Hai mentions in an explanation of this Gemara that there was one of the Goinim about 200 years before his time, one of the Goinim, Rabbi Avraham Kabasi, who actually knew how to understand the speech of the trees. He would see the trees waving in the wind, and he would be able to understand what they're actually saying to one another. So this is the kind of thing we're saying that 1,000 years before this Rebbe Avraham, Rebbe Yechiman Zakkai knew that as well. The sichas Malachi Asharis and the speech of the Malachi Asharis, also Rashbam says to be able to be mashbiya them, to be able to be swear them to do what you need. So Rabbi Yechiman Zakkai knew all those things. The Dover Godo, the Dover Cotton. He also knew the small things, and he also knew the big things and the small things. So what does that mean? Dover Godo means Maisim Merkava. All the details were Maisim Merkava from Yechezkel, which is all the source of many different concepts and ideas in Kabbalah. So he knew all of that. Dover Cotton is Havaya Stabaya Verova, the discussions of Abaya and Rava, which make up a large part of the Gemara, where Abaya and Rava are discussing various Mishnayos and Braises and pointing out difficulties with them and reconciling them. Rashi in this Gemara is also in Sukkah. Rashi in Sukkah explains, now Abaya and Rava are hundreds of years after Rabbi Yechiman Zakkai. If he already knew these things, why do they have to be discussing them in their time? So Rashi in Sukkah says there that during the time between Rabbi Yechiman Zakkai and Abaya and Rava, these points have been forgotten. So now Abaya and Rava had to bring them up again and chew them over and discuss them. How could we call a poet of Torah Dover Cotton? So there's actually also on that Gemara in Sukkah, there's long Pirushim from the Rashba and the Ritva, which actually are printed in Ein Yaakov there on Sukkah, where both of them discuss at great length this whole matter. Now, in their times, there was a popular notion that a lot of people had that partly, not just based on this Gemara, but based on a number of other factors as well, people argued that that Nigla is, the Gemara seems to say, Dover Cotton. It's something unimportant, as for Shalom. So they said the important thing is philosophy, the important thing is like the early forms, the early versions of the early discussions of Kabbalah that were starting in that time. They were putting down the whole idea of learning Nigla and learning Prakta and learning Gemara and practical Halacha and all. So the Rashba and the Ritva both had to fight very strongly against that in their time. The Rashba, in fact, eventually had to make a cherem in his times against people who study philosophy before a certain age. Because partially people were getting into that, and they were not only neglecting Torah, but they were starting to use it to misinterpret Torah. Anyway, so both of them explain that, no, when the Gemara says Dover Cotton over here, it doesn't mean that it's a Dover Cotton in and of itself. They're much more important than any philosophies and sciences and any of that sort of thing. They're cotton. It's cotton relative to Maisim Merkava. When you get to Maisim Merkava, is the dynamics of how things work in the Olam HaSoyonim, from which comes everything, from there comes everything in our world, then relative to that, the Nigla of Torah, which deals with things in our world, is Dover Cotton. But not Dover Cotton relative to all the other philosophies and sciences and bodies of knowledge and whatnot, chas v'shalom. And the Ritva adds another point as well. Look, we're saying that why did Abaya and Rava have to discuss these things? Because they had been forgotten since the time of Rabbi Yechiman Zakkai. You get down to Bechlal. Why are there kashas in the first place? Because one generation doesn't understand what the previous one taught, and therefore they have kashas on it. So relative to that, then it can be called a Dover Cotton in the sense the later generation are ketanim, and therefore they don't fully understand what the great ones before them said. Rav Levick, that his father talks in a number of places about the, on a deeper level also, for example, Maisim Merkava, which is Pnimius HaTorah, is connected more with the letters Yud and Hey of the Eivishter's name, Chochmah and Bina, whereas Nigla is connected more with Zah and Malchus, which are the Vav and the Hey, so that's another reason why to call them Dover Godol versus Dover Cotton, etc. Anyway, Lekayim Mashanema, this fulfills what it says in the pasuk, "La'hanchil oyavayesh," Hashem says, "to give my to cause my beloved ones to inherit to inherit yesh something substantial, which also represents bin yud olamus, the 310 worlds that the Mishnah tells us that Hashem is going to give every tzaddik, and I will fill up their treasuries." So in other words, the Rashbam says each tzaddik is going to get yesh. Why? Because it's the same amale, because their treasuries are full of all things of Torah and Chochmah, this whole catalog of things that we just said over here. The Marshal says a different meaning of it as well. It means that because he had, when we look at this whole list of things, it comes out he knew all the different branches of knowledge that anybody could possibly have. Therefore, the Lahanchil Oyava Yesh, Hashem granted him that Yesh, that tremendous amount of knowledge to know all the things of the world, and there's nothing lacking. But it's just Sam Amali, there's nothing lacking that he didn't learn. But we're saying, on the other hand, Marshall says, on the other hand, then you have to ask, so then what are the greater ones greater at? And the answer is the greater ones are greater. They have a greater seichel and more capability of learning these things even deeper and deeper, and therefore the Eibishter gives them more and more schar and olam haba. So the question is, the Gemara asks, the Chima Achad, the Kotten Shebekolim Kain, well, if the least of them, if Rabbi Yechon and Zakkai is of such caliber, Godol Shebekolim, Alachas Kama V'Kama, then you have to imagine, what was the greatest of them? What was Yonis and Menuzio like? So Omru Olaval, Yonis and Menuzio. So they said about Yonis and Menuzio, B'Shar Shed Yoshev V'Osik Batorah, when he would sit and study Torah, Kol Oifshe Pereach Olav Nisraf, any bird that would fly overhead over him would be burnt. Now, the Meiri says that means more symbolically. It means, in other words, even if somebody has, like, the sharpest brain, he's like a bird that can immediately fly from one place to another, if he was faced with Yonis and Benazir, like we had before with Shammai, he would immediately, like, he'd be burnt up, like he wouldn't have anything to answer. Most of the Mepharshim seem to understand it more literally, and they talk of it literally, partially about the Kedusha of him, that he's learning with such Kedusha and Tara, and he's bringing down, it's like Me'ein when the Torah was given, which was also Mitocha Eish, so therefore that brings about a fire that burns up any bird that passes by over there. It's an interesting thing that there's the Yerushalmi, I think, that says that Hillel himself was of the same caliber and even more, something along the lines of that Yonis and Menuzio, the fire would affect the bird over his head only to a distance of 4 amas, whereas Hillel would be even higher than that. There's a different other interesting, the Fas Emes over here brings a cute vort on it from the Kotzker. He says, on the contrary, Yonis and Menuzio, the Kedusha of him would spread out so much that was saying that it would burn up any bird that passed by. Meanwhile, Hillel had such great control over the Kedusha that he's able to control that it doesn't burn any birds. This is the famous vort that the Rebbeim said on it, that you see here the difference between how different people learn Gemara, where one kind of person is going to learn this and be overawed by the tzidkus and the chsidus of Yonis and Menuzio, and meanwhile a different person is going to be getting into the technicalities and clearing of whether Yonis and Menuzio would be chayev to pay for the nezek for the bird if it belongs to somebody, etc. There's that well known vort that Rebbeim said about chsidim and misnagdim respectively. Yeah. Misha Mes Perek Chi, so the ninth Perek of Omer Sefta, continues talking about these various dinim of disposition of Yerusha. The Mishnah says, Misha Mes V'yineach Bonim U'Bonim. So a person passed away, and he left sons and daughters. Bizman Sha Nechosim Merubin. So if the Nechosim are a large amount, and the Gemara discusses what's the, basically the, a large amount is enough to be able to, that the sons can yarshin, and also that there's enough money to support the daughters. The Gemara discusses whether it means enough to support them for 12 months after the father passes away. Is it enough to support them until they're a marriageable age? Whatever the case, if there's enough Nechosim for that, then good. Habonim Yushu. Then the sons inherit the property. V'abonis yizoynu, and the daughters have a certain amount of the nechosim earmarked for their support. The imla, nechosim mu'otin, but if you have only a small amount of nechosim, not enough for that. Habonis yizoynu, the daughters still get their amount earmarked for them. So, v'abonim yishalu ala psochim, and the sons, if necessary, are going to have to go begging by the daughters. Meaning, in other words, there's a certain amount earmarked for the daughters that the sons can't touch. They're being migash on the Gemara over here. Brings one, that's one point. He says another point is, let's say you could have the Gemara discusses what happens if the nechosim were a large amount when the father passed away and afterwards the value went down, and what about vice versa? So that's another. So in any case, the point is that the daughters are guaranteed their mizonos. It's actually one of the Tanoi Ksuba, and the sons, if there's not enough for them, or if the value went down or whatever, if necessary, they're going to have to go begging for their parnasa. On the other hand, the Mishnah continues, Admon, who was one of the Gemara tells us in Ksubas that he was one of the Dayonic Zeris in Yerushalayim. There were Dayonim, there was a basin over there. Admon was one of the members of it, where the head of it, or whatever, where they were in particular, they dealt with certain cases of Dine Momenus. They specialized in that. They made Takonis and Xeris as far as that, so they were called Dayonic Xeris. Admon was one of those Dayonim. Anyway, he says, what's the logic? Just because I'm a son, I should lose out on a case like that? So, the Gemara asks, what does Admon mean? My karma. I'm gonna buy a hockey comma. What Admon's argument is the shvil shani zochav roy ani lasik paterda. Because I'm a boy and therefore I'm capable of being oisik paterda if sadi. Therefore, so in other words, you see that I have an advantage over a girl and that I have the schus of learning Torah. Does that mean that in a case like this, I should therefore lose out? In other words, Admon's point is you shouldn't have those mizonos earmarked for the girls. If there's little enough nechosim, let them all share in it equally as best as they can. And eventually, when it runs out, rather than that we remove from the boys entirely. Omale Rava, but Rava says that can't be what it means. Elameata, by that logic, Manda Osik Batoru Diyoris, does that imply that if a person has two sons and one of them learns Torah, then he should Yarshin, and if he doesn't learn Torah, then he should lose his Yerusha. We just said before, you shouldn't disinherit a son. So fine. Tosfos points out the Gemara is going to continue saying, we'll learn tomorrow, Bez Hashem, that you are supposed to, a father is supposed to support his sons when they're learning Torah, but nevertheless, that's as far as the father has a mitzvah to do it. But we're certainly not going to say when it comes to the din of Yerusha that a son who learns Torah has an advantage over one who doesn't, so that can't be Adman's argument. Elo, Omer Rava Hachi Karma. So rather, Rava says, what Adman means is, B'shvil shani zocher v'roi ani lirush v'nechosim merubim, because I'm a boy, and had there been nechosim merubim, then I would yarshin everything, and all the daughters would get as their mezonis earmarked for them. Hifsadti b'nechosim watim, does that mean that when they're nechosim watim, on the other hand, it should be completely flipped around, and I get nothing, and they get earmarked for them whatever they can? So that's his argument. Whether the halacha is like him or not is machlokas rishonim. The Gemara mentions that in the mission over here, Rav Shimon Gamliel says, Roya anias divrei Adman. I find what Adman is saying very logically compelling. The Gemara says, when Rav Shimon Gamliel says that, that implies the halacha is like him, but rishonim disagree whether that rule applies across the board, and therefore whether the halacha is like Adman over here. And in times of the Rishonim, by the way, they came up with something which you can find the details of in Shulchan Aruch. People eventually did want to have that they leave a certain amount of Yerusha to their daughters, even though the Torah doesn't provide for that. So they came up with something you can find in Shulchan Aruch called Shtar Chatzi Zocher. Basically, the idea is you write a shtar in such a way that the daughter is owed X amount of money by the boys, and therefore they have to pay it to her just like they would pay any other kind of chayv. It's a long story, but that's the heart of it. Yom Yom Mashiach Ha'Goloch Avav Nissen. So here these weeks we're learning Pirkei Avos. So the Rebbe is talking about that we have to be increasing during this time of year in Torah and Mitzvahs, especially as man grama of keeping the minhag of learning Pirkei Avos after Mincha between Pesach and Shavuos, and then as the Alter Rebbe goes on to say Yesh Noyagin, that some have the minhag to do throughout the summer, and eventually that became the standard Lubavitcher minhag. So first of all, the person himself has to increase in that. Second of all, to be mashpia on other people, to also increase in it, especially if the mashpia himself was previously lacking in that shleimus of his avoda, he himself has to add kiflayim l'toshia, and part of that is by having ashpa on others. And in general, this kind of avoda of afotza satura, of ayadus, and afotza samayonus potza brings especially osi mar domar from mashicha. Continuing on halachas of tzitzis, so we were talking yesterday about the minimum lengths for the tzitzis strings. So if you want to make the tzitzis longer, you can do that. You can make them really as long as you want, as long as they don't drag on the ground. In fact, it's better to do that, the Alter Rebbe adds, because this way, even if they break, then you still have the minimum 12 good limb of length. Earlier in Simon Tess, we learned that the tzitzis have to be mimin ha'konaf, and we had the whole discussion about when you have a garment made out of a certain material, what material do the tzitzis strings need to be made out of. So there we talk about wool versus linen versus silk versus all the other fabrics, etc. So now you have another point as well. You can't now if you have, let's say, for example, sheep sometimes sit among the thorns, and some of their wool tears off and gets caught on the thorns. You wouldn't use, or you have other examples, threads that are pulled off from the sheep, or sometimes when you're weaving cloth, you have remnants that are left over there. Now, those kinds of things are not made into garments, because they're like the psoilus of the wool. Therefore, you also can't use them from tzitzis, because that wouldn't be hakonef. It wouldn't, even though wool is wool. You could argue, but no, because these are inferior kinds of wool, or whatever fabric, and therefore you can't use them for tzitzis. And the same way, in general, any other type, inferior type of wool, you wouldn't make a beged out of them, therefore you can't make tzitzis out of them either. Now you have a din. If a person stole threads that had been made l'shem tzitzis, and he makes tzitzis out of them, then they would be posel, because v'osel lahem means it has to be yours, not gezel. If the gazlan sold the tzitzis to other people, to somebody else, then it depends whether there's yush, then it depends whether the owner was miyash or not, because then you have yush v'shinu reshus, then you have the owner was miyash, and there's also a transference of ownership, and that already makes it lahalacha that the second person now owns them, and only the value of it has to be returned to the original person. So therefore, that would be the case over here as well, and he would and therefore he would be yotze. The Alter Rebbe brings over here in Kutta Sacharin, you have a similar thing as far as a lulav agozel. So there's a difference, and again, as Alter Rebbe is saying over here, there's a difference between whether there was Yush or not. Now, the Alter Rebbe continues. What happens if a person's soul rule that wasn't yet spun, and he spun it L'shem Tzitzis? So now it also depends. If there was no Yush yet, then there's still Puzzle, because there's still Gezel, and it's Shinu Achoy, the fact that he makes them into threads, is called Shinu Achoy Zulibri Yosef, because it can be restored to its original state. The Gemara talks about in Baba Kama, that when you have the Gazlan makes a Shinu in it, but the Shinu can be easily undone, then it's not Koine. And here, just spinning them is not considered that kind of irrevocable change. If the owner already had Yush, but if the, or the Gazlan made a Shinu Gummer, something that's never going to change, for example, bleaching it without ever mentions with sulfur, then already he's koine it, so he wouldn't have to pay, he wouldn't have to give back the original wool, so therefore it's shaloi, and therefore it's kosher, but you still don't make a bracha on it, because we would say a beirach niyetz Hashem, to make a bracha on something that was brought about by Veda, is still angering Hashem. You have a similar concept, we'll learn eventually, in Hilchos Brachos, of a person eats stolen food, you have many other such examples. Not a man, I can't show myself what's the whole Zaka's self.